I'd like to welcome you to the 34th Malinowski Memorial Lecture. The first in the series was given by Edmund Leach in 1959 under the now celebrated, then presumably rather irreverent title, Rethinking Anthropology. And irreverence has become part of the best traditions of this lecture. Unlike other named lectures in anthropology, which tend to be delivered in measured tones by senior, long-established colleagues, the intention behind the Malinowski Memorial Lecture is to provide a platform for a rising star in the discipline. And it doesn't take much perspicacity to recognize Dr. Jonathan Spencer as that. The interest in the significance of his work is already widely acknowledged both here in the United States and on the Indian subcontinent. Jonathan Spencer did his first degree from the University of Edinburgh. He then studied at the University of Chicago before coming back to Britain for his DPhil at Oxford, which he completed in 1986 after an extended period of fieldwork in Sri Lanka. He subsequently taught at Sussex and, all too briefly, at the LSE, returning to Edinburgh in 1989, where he's now a senior lecturer. He's about to take up a visiting fellowship at Harvard to complete one book, and an Nuffield Fellowship to start another book. In important respects, Dr. Spencer's first book marked a watershed in the anthropology of Sri Lanka. While the great majority of the earlier monographs on the island had focused on kinship, ritual, and religion, and on, as it were, enduring features of some apparently fairly stable social structure, Dr. Spencer's original fieldwork coincided with a terrifying upsurge of communal violence and was conducted in a village to which a very large proportion of the population were relative newcomers. A similar village in a time of trouble is a path-breaking study in the way in which it manages to use village-level data to illuminate the deepening ethnic crisis at the level of the polity as a whole. And it's path-breaking also in the way in which it manages to show how the rituals and symbolism of Buddhist nationalism were used to recreate a sense of community, and it manages thereby to explain a great deal about the appeal of similar nationalism to ordinary people. Dr. Spencer's edited volume on the history and roots of the Sri Lankan crisis picks up and develops on many of the themes which were broached in that first monograph. And it shows how, far from being primordial, as has often been supposed, the similar Tamil conflict is the product of relatively recent historical forces. Nationalism, violence, political culture, the past as a political resource, ethnic and communal identities, fundamentalism. These then have been the central themes of Dr. Spencer's published work. But he's also written on a wide range of other topics, on socialism and Buddhism in Sri Lanka, on the concept of society, and on anthropology as a kind of writing, for example. Not only does his work have this impressive breadth, but it also comes in an admirably lucid and accessible form. So it's therefore with pleasurable anticipation that I call on Dr. Spencer to deliver his 1995 Malinowski Memorial Lecture on post-colonialism and the political imagination.
Thank you, Johnny, for that very kind introduction. This really is an enormous honour. Imagine yourself suddenly set down, surrounded by all your gear, alone on a tropical beach close to a native village, while they launch your dinghy, which has brought you, sails away, out of sight. No, don't. Let me quote instead from another less well-known passage by Malinowski. Imagine, not anything to do with launches, imagine yourself high in the air over Africa. Most of what follows is actually direct quotation. It is 1938 and you are a passenger flying over the inland route of the Imperial Airways, a route which our intellectual navigator assures us, can provide almost literally a bird's eye view of the cultural situation. As you cross the Upper Nile, the circular villages and unclothed natives give a surface effect of old Africa. But as the plane crosses the border between Nilotic and Bantu peoples, it becomes obvious that it is a transformed Africa over which we are moving. Among the Baganda, the houses are new, square, built on the European pattern. Even from above, and one wonders about how high the Imperial Airways used to fly, even from above, the dress and equipment of the natives spell Manchester and Birmingham. Then, moving on, in Nairobi we enter a world where natives and things African seem to play but the role of mutes and properties respectively. The white inhabitants go about their European business and live in a world almost untouched on its surface by Africa. And then, shifting the visual metaphor into full imperial gear, we can conclude that changing Africa is not a single subject matter, but one composed of three phases. It would be almost possible to take a piece of chalk and on the face of the continent to map out spatially the areas of each type, predominantly European, genuinely African, and those covered by the processes of change. I've been quoting, as some of you will have already realised, from Malinowski's 1938 introduction to a collection of essays from Africa, published as Methods of Study of Culture Contact in Africa. It's an essay full of surprises, and I commend it to anyone still attached to the two-dimensional reading of Malinowski's Colonial Villain. I don't want to go into that side of the essay, though. What I want to start with is something else, with the piece of chalk and the line on the map which separates genuinely African, predominantly European, and the processes of change. Circular villages and new square houses. Unclothed natives and this mysterious dress which spells Manchester and Birmingham. Or, as Malinowski put it in the same essay, Old Africa, Imported Europe, and the New Composite Culture. One part of my lecture concerns the way in which the political structure of colonial rule shaped the social imagination of both coloniser and colonised, leaving behind a vocabulary of social types and political possibilities which continues to haunt us 30, 40, or 50 years later. I want to deal with this later by looking at some striking cases of post-colonial politics from South Asia. But first I want to look at some of the reasons why anthropologists have paid less attention than they might to post-colonial politics. In this case, I want to follow the implications of that clear line between genuine Africa and the processes of change. This strikes me as an exemplary case of a way of talking about social and cultural differences, which is, in fact, steeped in the history and politics of late colonial rule, but which has continued to loiter like an unwanted intellectual guest, years after the political circumstances which gave rise to it in the first place have disappeared. And of course, any critical analysis of that kind of move leads me in the direction of a much broader intellectual movement which has become associated with the term post-colonial. What's become known in recent years as post-colonial theory is mostly manifest in literary criticism and cultural studies, with offshoots across the humanities and social sciences. Its great sort of founding work is almost certainly Edward Said's Orientalism, while its most influential exponents now are probably post-structuralist conjurers like Homi Bhabha and Gayatri Spivak. In fact, to my embarrassment, my lecture has less to do with this body of work than my title might imply. Since Professor Parry, in a moment of madness last year, encouraged me to settle on the present title, his exact words were something like, "Oh, that sounds really sexy, you must do that one." I've watched in horror and amazement as this thing called post-colonial theory has become the subject of ever more articles, books, readers, introductions. I mean, a visit to somewhere like Blackwell's never failed to find 5, 6, or 7 more books with the P word in the title. And, of course, advertisements for employment in institutions of higher education. I'll come back to this phenomenon at the end of my lecture in order to justify my own more prosaic use of the term post-colonial. But in this lecture, and looking around me, I see I was right to guess this, I am of necessity addressing an audience of anthropologists. So my priorities are sometimes going to be rather parochially anthropological, even though the issues I deal with are of much broader import. My own use of this term post-colonial stems from my own fieldwork in Sri Lanka, where I acquired the irritating habit of lecturing fellow field workers about what I saw as the irreducible fact that the country in which we were working had not merely been colonised, it had been very colonised. And every relationship we entered into as field workers bore witness to this fact. When I completed my doctorate and was admitted to the ranks of the ASA a few years later, and I had to fill in that form where you say what your research interests are, I rather proudly wrote down post-colonial culture and politics. A little later still, rereading my old teacher Bernard Cohn's essays when they were published together in one volume, I realised with a start that I'd been echoing something he had written long before. He'd said, in a very real way, the subject matter of anthropology has been the study of the colonised, a point, of course, made at about the same time by a number of other people. This would be about the early 70s. Now, Cohn's assertion tells us something about power and something about history, and I want to concentrate for now on the historical implication of that statement. The facts of colonisation and the facts of decolonisation do not in themselves serve to constitute a homogeneous theoretical object, post-colonial culture or post-colonial society. What they can do, quite valuably I think, is to serve as a mnemonic, as a salutary jolt to remind the complacent ethnographer that these places have histories, and in particular that their political institutions are the product of both a moment of colonial implantation and a subsequent post-colonial history. In his late writings on change in Africa, Malinowski coined a rather contemporary-sounding term to describe such moments of colonial implantation. He called them moments of transculturation. In particular, he argued that apparently Western institutional forms, first of many imaginary scare quotes around the word Western, the word our, me, I, and so on all the way through have imaginary scare quotes around them. He argued that apparently Western institutional forms like mines, plantations, or factories, transplanted into African circumstances, must be interpreted in their own terms as quite new phenomena. And he said, even a material object, a tool or an instrument like money, changes in the very process of culture contact. He also, I think somewhat unexpectedly to a late reader like myself, railed against futile ethnographic attempts to reconstruct a world of pure tradition in the face of change. And yet for all his dismissal of what he called an untouched native culture, which he dismissed as only a figment, and of course, being Malinowski, he didn't believe in studying figments, there remains that line drawn in imaginary chalk, those clear areas of old Africa, which he felt were so self-evidently different from the new. And indeed, once he actually developed his argument, moved from the level of observation to the level of analysis, so his three zones of the genuine, the imported, and the composite became three analytic phases to be charted in three columns. Elements of the indigenous culture, elements of the impinging culture, and the process of contact and change. In other words, what at one moment is dismissed as a figment, the idea of an untouched native culture, reappears a few sentences later as an unproblematic analytic category in the study of contact and change. And I think Malinowski is in a rather schizophrenic position here. As an anthropologist and as a fully paid-up member of the colonial order, Malinowski continued to believe in a zone of tradition, enclaved in space or removed in time, which could continue to serve as an anthropological and legal and administrative point of departure. But as in Edmund Leach's memorable phrase, a radical empiricist, he insisted on the study of the here and now, And this meant a study of the transformation of both local and non-local institutions in the colonial setting. I want to use this opportunity to set out a case for a kind of post-colonial anthropology which attends to this second possibility. What was left behind after the flags were lowered and the new leaders sworn in was not just a lingering nostalgia for the royal family or a passionate commitment to 19th century British team sports or an often hopeless dependence on the fluctuations of world capitalism, although all of these are unmistakable features of parts of the post-colonial landscape. What was also left behind was a set of institutions, police and courts and legal codes, schools and clinics, a civil service, accompanied by a basic political vocabulary founded on a number of linked ideas. These ideas included the legitimacy of the post-colonial nation-state as an ideal framework for political life, a legitimacy usually justified by some appeal to the virtues of representative democracy, thus involving the sovereignty of some collective entity known as the people, whose political will is properly expressed by its chosen representatives. Of course, once we actually see what happened to these ideas in practice, the story gets murky. The more specific our focus, the more problems arise. Which nation-state is legitimate? Who or what constitutes the people? And who claims to speak for or represent them, and on what grounds? So I want to argue that, at first at least, the problem for anthropology is as much as anything an empirical one. The political imagination in post-colonial states is at once particularly interesting and as well interestingly particular. Later in this lecture I shall look at three examples from South Asia: the intense electoral politics of Sri Lanka, the attempt by the Nepali powers that be in the 1980s to reconcile the claims of democracy with the master metaphor of divine kingship, and what we could call the politics of pure representation found in the Tamil-speaking parts of South India and Sri Lanka in recent years. But before I get on to all of that, I want to dwell for a moment on anthropology's empirical failings in this area. In the great own-up section at the end of Volume 1 of Coral Gardens and Their Magic, All the Things I Missed Out from the Other Books, Malinowski referred to his earlier pursuit of what he called the real savage, in preference to the changing Melanesian he found himself actually observing, as the most serious shortcoming of his Melanesian research. And he attributed this error to his lingering attachment to what he called the antiquarian anthropology of his youth. Now, what's interesting is the extent to which subsequent anthropologists have ignored Malinowski's unusually harsh self-criticism on this point, continuing to prefer the search for the real over the acknowledgement of change. And in part, this is simply because Malinowski's extreme empiricism is simply impossible. Nobody can or would want to observe everything they see in front of them with equal attention. And in practice, any ethnographer filters his or her observations. And in filtering, they tend to concentrate on whatever looks most obviously anthropological. One of my favourite passages from 70s anthropology is a quote: "I am among the Dors of southern Ethiopia, and I am studying their symbolism. Someone explains to me how to cultivate fields. I listen with a distracted ear. Someone tells me that if the head of the family does not himself sow the first seeds, the harvest will be bad. This I note immediately." This is Dan Sperber from Rethinking Symbolism. What Sperber says of the symbolic and its power to wake the slumbering ethnographer can, I think, be generalised wider. Who cares how they cultivate their fields, or where they buy their powdered milk, or how they judge the reported actions of their political leaders? We think we know about cultivation or market relations or party politics, not least because these are all things we might do ourselves. Again, imaginary scare quotes and all the wheeze. It seems to require some defamiliarising jolt, some little bit of the symbolic, to remind anthropologists that all these actions are actually rather interesting, or they might be rather interesting. I'm not saying they have to be interesting. Sometimes they are indeed just as boring as we think they are. But without that jolt, whole areas of life disappear into a haze of apparent familiarity. Something else, though, happened to politics. In Britain, political anthropology as a specialised subdiscipline developed in a kind of unhealthy schismogenesis with the first stirrings of structuralism and symbolic anthropology in the 50s and 60s. Where others had all the fun speaking of cosmologies and modes of thought, ritual and symbol, unconscious structures, implicit meanings, political anthropology became determinedly unexotic, anti-cultural and dull. By about 1970, all the richness and complexity of actually existing politics had been reduced by anthropologists to the micro-study of instrumental behaviour. Political anthropology, so conceived, was the sub-discipline that died of boredom. And James Carrier has helpfully coined the expression auto-narcosis to describe this common academic malaise. We can think of plenty of other examples, either where it's occurred or where we think it might occur in the future. But subdisciplines do not develop in isolation, and I'm concerned not just with what was missing from political anthropology, but more with what parts of life were or were not thought appropriate for anthropological analysis in general, with the ways in which anthropologists drew imaginary chalk marks around some areas of life and quietly ignored others. Structuralists got myth, ritual, and the last old villager, who might just remember how things used to be. Political anthropologists, on the other hand, got factions, networks, action sets, and much apparently meaningless politicking. In all of this, nobody much seemed interested in the promises and language of post-colonial politicians, or in the imaginative challenge posed by the political logic of mass elections. In what follows, I'm going to emphasise the cultural oddities of other people's politics, but lest I be accused of reproducing this unhealthy split between interesting symbols and dull but worthy practices, I should at least mention that the people encountered in my examples are also fueled by passions and interests, and these are themselves channeled in particular directions by institutional structures. However, as two political philosophers, Charles Taylor and Alistair McIntyre, argued 20 years ago in critiques of the existing dreary forms of political science, no adequate account of mass politics can possibly afford to ignore people's own sense of what ought to be. It is this sense which informs their evaluation of politics as it is in the here and now, and it is also this sense which animates or constrains their sense of what is possible in the future. I've chosen to refer to this triangle of animation, constraint, and evaluation as the political imagination. Let me now expand my argument through the use of one particularly distinguished and important contribution, one exception to my rather crude characterisation of 60s political anthropology. Clifford Geertz's comparative essays on nationalism and political culture, which are collected in the bit of The Interpretation of Cultures that the students never read, the first of which were published when he was a member of the Committee for the Study of New Nations in Chicago in the early 60s. On the one hand, Geertz is unusual in acknowledging the cultural implications of decolonisation. The new states, as they were then called, he says, are going through a period of disorientation, groping, as he puts it, for usable political concepts, searching for a new symbolic framework in terms of which to formulate, think about, and react to political problems. Or, in a later essay, he talks about the transition from colonial to post-colonial as a sort of social changing of the mind or conceptual dislocation affecting the most familiar frames of moral and intellectual perception. It begins to sound more like anthropology put in these terms. Now, there is, of course, more than a touch in this of what I think of as the Chicago fallacy, the idea that there are few problems encountered in the world which cannot be resolved by reorganizing your reading list, coupled with the confidence that this problem is at the heart of the human condition everywhere. But even leaving that aside, there is still much in Geertz's formulation that repays reflection. In the best known of his essays in comparative politics, the Integrative Revolution, Geertz analyses the politics of the post-colonial world in terms of two opposing forces: the pull of what he calls primordial attachments versus the virtue of civil sentiments. The dichotomy, in fact, comes from Ed Shills, as this is the LSE. You perhaps remember that. On the one side, the imperatives of blood and belonging, ethnicity, language, race. On the other, the sanitized attractions of a modern state. But once we actually get to the essay itself, it is the primordial which attracts most of Geertz's analytic and empirical attention. That the idea of civil society and civic sentiments may also be actually rather problematic categories is briefly acknowledged at the end of the essay and then rather quickly brushed aside. What happens, in fact, is that the primordial emerges as the marked category, as that which requires documentation and analysis, while the civic is defined essentially as the absence of the primordial. It's whatever modern people do when they stop being primordial. As societies become properly modern, and this is a quote from the essay, to an increasing degree, national unity is maintained not by calls to blood and land, but by a vague, intermittent, and routine allegiance to a civil state. This is an American speaking, interestingly enough. And who wants to come back from 2 years in the tropics or wherever with meticulous documentation of something already known to be vague, intermittent and routine? The prospect is about as appealing as doing an ethnography of the weather forecast. Now, insofar as anthropologists have turned their attention in recent years back to the politics of the post-colonial world, they've continued to work within this same framework, concentrating above all on the peculiarities of what is presented as the primordial. That defamiliarising jolt to the otherwise slumbering ethnographer is now administered by the calls to blood and land, by nationalism, especially if it happens to be violent, especially if it happens to be at its sort of bloodiest and most exotic. While the broader political framework of the post-colonial nation-state is still treated as relatively unproblematic. We're fascinated by the moment of ethnic conflict, but we don't really inquire into the institutional structure that conflict grows out of. Or to put it another way, we've continued to draw that chalk line across the ethnographic map, and it's no surprise to learn that we remain as entranced as ever by the enclave containing the genuine African or the genuine Indian or the genuine whoever. Even if genuineness is now usually construed by the people themselves in highly self-conscious and occasionally bloodthirsty ways. What I want to do in the rest of this lecture is try to turn this around by convincing you that our political vocabulary and our political institutions, as encountered in those other places we once ruled, I have to keep doing that, are much more puzzling and mysterious than we might think. Malinowski cited money as an example of something which may be quite transformed by a change of cultural context. But we know that until very recently, anthropologists have frequently credited money, or the arrival of Western commodities, with an inherent power to change all it touches. With money, so the folk anthropology runs, comes the Coca-Cola signs, MTV, and the imminent demise of all that makes a particular place distinctive and interesting. Money is above all our sign of the cultural corrosiveness of modernity. But the most interesting recent work in the study of consumption, exchange and material life reveals that there's much more variety in the local uses and responses to money and commodities than we might have expected. Whether this variety adds up to the larger argument, which I have heard put forward, that capitalism itself is plural, taking radically different forms in different cultural contexts, is as yet undecided, not least because we're only now beginning to develop the critical ethnography we need in order to address the question, including, of course, the critical ethnography of capitalism in its own Western setting. The political vocabulary of the nation-state, by contrast, has been more often treated as culturally neutral, as indifferent to difference, rather than as corrosive of difference. Partly this is because of the reason I already alluded to, that as anthropologists we've identified certain ideas and practices as essentially Western and therefore requiring no further investigation. And partly I think it's also because we're still easily swayed by a kind of vulgar Weberianism which treats bureaucratic rationality too much at its own disenchanted face value. Let me recapitulate my argument so far. In the first part of the lecture, I analysed a tension in Malinowski's late writings on the effects of colonialism. On the one hand, he insisted that field workers should concentrate on the present rather than attempt a reconstruction of the authentic native past, and that in doing so they would find that ostensibly European features of native life had been transformed in their new cultural context. Nevertheless, Malinowski insisted that a clear line could still be drawn between those purely indigenous elements of life, the real Africa, and the new composite culture of European rule. In the second part, I suggested, with breathtaking generalisation, that anthropologists have continued to draw such a line, quietly eliminating from ethnographic view those areas of life we think we already know because we already have them ourselves. The political vocabulary of the modern nation-state is one such item with which anthropologists have taken to be either unproblematic or boring or both. In the rest of the lecture, I want to look at some examples of actually existing politics from one part of the post-colonial world, from South Asia, in order to demonstrate two things. Firstly, that they're inherently of enormous human and therefore anthropological interest, and secondly, that anthropology is well placed to provide some answers to their more mysterious aspects. Now, this argument is the development of a long, slow process of reflection, which is triggered by events I witnessed well over a decade ago now. In the second part of 1982, I was living in a sprawling rural settlement in central Sri Lanka, alternating between anxiety and boredom, sometimes managing to combine the two in rare moments of illumination, in a mood familiar to most field workers. Then suddenly, an election broke out in the village. Neighbours ceased to smile at each other in their usual neighbourly way. And my field notes started to expand exponentially as political rivals sought me out in order to get their verbal retaliation in first. By the end of the election, one side, the losers, were cowering fearfully in their houses, awaiting, as they saw it, physical attack from the other side, the winners. But in this village at this time, the winners contented themselves with visiting the pleasures of non-violent humiliation on their opponents, dancing in the street, dropping their clothes around them, parading around the village chanting insults, and drinking enormous quantities of unpleasant alcohol. And I don't speak as an alcohol eater myself. The usual political stuff, in other words. But somehow it still seemed rather more than this. As an undergraduate in Edinburgh, I remember the professor of politics used to start his first year lectures with the altogether helpful observation that in strictly statistical terms, any direct political engagement in Britain could be classified as a deviant activity. And if you stop to think about it, a great deal of British political life begins to make more sense. Not so in this village in Sri Lanka, where all or nearly all were involved and implicated, where everyone seemed to share a fascination with politics, both local and national, and where an amazingly high proportion of the village population were publicly identified as belonging to one of the two major national parties. Where, in fact, in a curious way, the political permeated the texture of everyday life, even while the state itself often seemed quite remote and foreign. I could obviously expand this ethnographic case at much greater length and have done elsewhere. In particular, I've tried to show the way in which nationalist attachments had roots in particular social circumstances, and also the way in which the appropriation of the post-colonial state as a resource in local politics introduces a new element of danger in the fabric of local argument, an argument which I've subsequently realised could be generalised from a lot of other cases around the world, such as, say, Guatemala, which I've been recently reading about. But my point today is this. Mass politics, which were introduced in Sri Lanka with universal suffrage in 1931, indeed, universal suffrage has almost as long a history there as it does in Britain, and which were enthusiastically embraced by the population in subsequent elections, presented people like these villagers with a new possibility. The possibility that mass politics opened up was the creation of an apparently bounded and structured, subsequent events have revealed that it wasn't quite that at all, but an apparently bounded and structured social arena in which to work through all manner of purely local tensions and differences, while nevertheless seeking more of the good things and social standing that follow from access to the state. Something between a tournament of value like the cooler and a rite of reversal like carnival. And the point of invoking the cooler and the carnival is that what was happening was a great deal odder and more interesting than the prosaic label local-level politics prepared me for. In short, it was cultural. And being cultural was preeminently worthy of anthropological attention. Now, elsewhere I've tried to analyse all of this in terms of one set of political institutions, those of representative electoral democracy with their own history and implications, in a place like this, being reinterpreted in an idiom derived from a quite different political tradition, in the end from that of Buddhist kingship. Such reinterpretation is never entirely predictable, nor is it ever complete. The best known examples of previous attempts to analyse this kind of rather complex historical process, in which the political imagination is at once expanded and constrained by the new institutional arrangements of the post-colonial world, involve, I think, the 20th century history of Southeast Asia, Benedict Anderson's superb analysis of the sediments of the past in the world of New Order Indonesia, or Tambaya's delineation of continuities and transformations in the relationship between rulers and monks in Thailand in the 19th and 20th century. What I want to do now, though, is to shift attention to a country which, like Thailand, manages to be unarguably post-colonial without ever having been, properly speaking, colonial, that is, Nepal. Nepal's political twists are especially noteworthy. Whereas indigenous ideas about kingship have continued to animate the political imagination in Sri Lanka, but without any kings to do the animating since the early 19th century, In Nepal, kings have clung on despite constant pressure from the outside. But as Richard Burkhardt, who, it should be mentioned, was the first person to actually understand what I was doing several years before I realised myself what I was doing, and offered me a kind of encouragement that very few other people have ever offered me to at an early stage in my career. But as Richard Burkhardt made clear in a fascinating series of articles on the Nepali polity, only a few of which have been published, a combination of external and internal pressures forced the kings to come to terms with the idea of the nation-state as a coherent, bounded entity whose sovereignty could in some sense be represented as an expression of the will of some other entity called the people. Of course, even the idea of Nepal as an exemplary Hindu kingdom has its roots in the era of high colonialism. Nevertheless, according to the official ideal of kingship, the king in some sense incorporated the people themselves as part of the body politic. Internal divisions of the sort which are perfectly normal in party politics were quite literally unthinkable. Nepali political culture in the 1980s was, in Burkhardt's terms, lordly. I quote, "The public domain was personally represented by the sovereign, whose will was executed by his state agents for the common good of an indivisible body politic." So according to this theory, political parties would be the expression of private interests, and therefore had no place in the public sphere, as conceived in the radically different idiom of the official Nepali political imagination. But the fact that divisions were unthinkable doesn't mean, of course, that they didn't exist. In the course of a referendum on the constitution in 1980, the powers that be were in fact forced to organise themselves into something looking awfully like a political party in order to advance the view that parties were unnecessary and undesirable elements in the body politic. The resulting mishmash was something between Flannery O'Connor's fictional Holy Church of Christ Without Christ in Wise Blood and the Social Democratic Party of the early 1980s, a party pledged to take the politics out of politics. When Burkhardt carried out his fieldwork in 1984-5, there was a rising tide of dissent within the polity, looking for some medium in which to express itself. This in turn involved imagining a space for legitimate criticism. I'm afraid I contracted the Malinowski Memorial cold yesterday morning, so you'll have to bear with me while I blow my nose. This in turn involved imagining a space for legitimate criticism. Burkhardt analyses the way in which a teacher's strike was organised as an expression of dismay within the body of the state, rather than a protest directed at the state from some external public space, like a limb or an organ signifying through its pain a malaise affecting the whole body. The results, of course, were complex and involuted, each gesture on either side requiring repeated interpretation in order to tease out the political intention behind the surface forms of lordly deference. How much irony was there lurking in that marginally too lavish expression of praise and deference? Why did the official newspaper announce mysteriously one morning that nothing had happened on a particular day, unless it was conceding that something, a protest, a strike, was widely expected to happen, and in so conceding, was it therefore granting that something the right to exist? The questions piled up, and the hermeneutic work of political culture was never-ending in a situation which Burkhardt characterised as a counterfeit reality. Now, in this particular analysis, Burkhardt is, amongst other things, subjecting Habermas's arguments about criticism and the public sphere to a fairly startling revision in the light of the ways in which the very idea of criticism and the very idea of the public were configured in the official Nepali political imagination of the early 80s. But the Nepali case, as well as demonstrating the unexpected results of a historical moment in which the language of representative democracy coexists on a more or less equal footing with the language of divine monarchy, also highlights a recurring predicament in the practice of representative democracy everywhere. How do we construe the very idea of representation itself? In a moment, I'll turn to another example from South Asia, the larger-than-life politics of the state of Tamil Nadu. But first, I want to pause a moment to consider this idea of political representation. The idea of representation was crucial to the colonial political project in South Asia, well before it became attached to the specific idea of representative democracy, and not just in South Asia either. In the mid-19th century, according to Cohn's well-known essay on the representation of authority in colonial India, the one in The Invention of Tradition, official thinking was torn between two ideas about the nature of colonial rule and the sources of colonial authority. On the one hand, India could be seen as a relic of feudal society. If so, the colonial project required the identification of a native aristocracy to play the role of feudal intermediary between the Queen and her Indian subjects. Alternatively, India could be viewed in what he called a more modernist way, in which the whole society could be subdivided into differing communities, each with a collective interest which should be brought to the attention of government by an appropriate representative. Cohn's opposition between feudal and representational modes of colonial government evokes Tom Paine's distinction in The Rights of Man between the hereditary and the representative principle. But this distinction has never been quite as stark as Cohn sometimes seems to imply in his analysis. One way to link these ideas of community, representation and interest is to posit a social world, and this I think is in fact what happened in much of the colonial world, is to posit a social world which is divided into natural communities, each of which has its natural representatives. In India, it would be castes, tribes, races, or religious communities with their chiefs, landlords, princes, or aristocrats. What's at stake, actually, in Cohn's two types of colonial authority is not the issue of representation, but the link between the representative and the people who are represented. Broadly speaking, colonial modernizers were more inclined to allow some element of choice in people's relation to their representatives. They might choose the most appropriate representative. Whereas colonial traditionalists, on the other hand, were more likely to imagine the people sunk in the mire of unreflective traditional thought to such an extent that at any one time there could only ever be one natural representative. I mean, a very striking example of this occurs in David Land's ethnography of colonial Rhodesia in the 1960s, when certain colonial officials became convinced that all that was needed to win the hearts and minds of an ever more obviously disaffected peasantry was possession of the right genealogies from which to appoint the right chiefs. And if they were disaffected, it's because we got the wrong genealogy and we put the wrong chief in place. The issue of representation, of course, is not only a colonial problem. The rhetoric of political representation, the idea that the government is made up of men and women who can confidently claim to represent the interests of the people, is ubiquitous in the post-colonial world, and by no means confined to those pockets of it like India and Sri Lanka, where electoral politics have more or less survived intact. Everybody claims to be speaking for the people, one way or another. But even within its European history, the idea of political representation harbours important internal contradictions. Raymond Williams, in Key Words, notes the earliest usage of represent in the 14th century, in which the word carries the sense of making present, as in paintings or plays, bringing an image before the viewer. But its swift accrual of the slightly different meaning of standing for or symbolising. And as these words represent, representative and representation take on their modern political sense through the 17th and 18th century, this tension between making present the views of an absent person or persons and standing for or symbolising the persons themselves remains. A king may represent the kingdom, just as the crown may represent the king. But my local Labour Party delegate to party conference claims to represent the interests of the party members in a somewhat different way. This tension at the heart of the political vocabulary of the modern state is there famously when Marx says in the 18th Brumaire of the French peasantry, they cannot represent themselves, they must be represented. Although this sentence is probably most familiar now as the epigraph to Said's Orientalism, Marx was not writing about the peasantry's ability to write books about themselves, as this would imply. It takes a less political and more scholastic age to assume that this was their problem, indeed to assume that this is the problem of representation. He was puzzling, as so many good leftists have puzzled since, about the peasantry's political support for a representative, Louis Napoleon, whose intentions and interests seem so much at odds with their own. And of course, it's especially ironic that the puzzle Marx discusses here hinges on the problem of a social class apparently sharing common objective interests, yet unable to exercise collective agency. Well, of course, the thrust of most post-colonial, post-Said, post-Orientalist criticism has been the dogmatic substitution of contingency and fluidity for any allusion to collective identity or collective interests, a point made forcefully by David Washbrook and Polly O'Hanlon. What is interesting for my purposes, though, is the semantic or cultural emptiness of the idea of political representation. We all know there's a link between representative and represented, but we cannot necessarily specify what form that link may take. It may, for example, be a link of common substance. Fathers and kings may like to think of themselves as embodying those they are said to represent. Or it may be a contractual link, in which the representative is only temporarily mandated to put forward the views of those she represents, while those represented retain the right of recall at the first sign of their views being misrepresented. Again, those of you who are Labour Party members will recognise this delusion. Historically, the left has tried to treat all of this as a matter of institutional arrangements, to be resolved by structures of committees and meetings and delegates. Somebody pointed out to me the other day, one of the trade union leaders who had not balloted their members on the Clause 4 issue, put forward, I think, the perfectly reasonable argument that balloting is a rather crude and primitive form of democracy compared to the more sophisticated forms that have been worked up within the trade union movement. It is also, though, inevitably a problem of symbolism, in which issues of trust, community and agency are worked through at a rhetorical level. And this is a point, it's one of many points, but it's the point I've chosen tonight, at which culture can re-enter the political stage, as our own People's Party seems to have belatedly recognised in its recent election of an especially free-floating signifier as leader. And it is thus a point at which other people's politics can look the same, because they seem to share the same language of states and governments and the representation of the people. Nevertheless, they may be extraordinarily different, because there is a huge scope for different ways in which to construe the idea of the people, as well as the idea of representation, which supposedly binds them to the government. Nowhere demonstrates this conjuring trick of a politics at once apparently familiar, yet in practice startlingly different, better than the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu. Both poles of the equation, the people and the representatives, are built here out of unexpected elements. In mass politics in the last two or three decades, the people have tended to be defined in terms of Victorian racial theory, while the representatives have emerged from the all-singing, all-action world of the Tamil movie industry. The facts in themselves are extraordinary. The last three chief ministers of the state all had strong backgrounds in the movie industry. This is going back 20-odd years now. The dominant political personality of the post-independence period was M.G. Ramachandran, or MGR as he was universally known. After playing the... Oops. That's something I never planned to do. The Malinowski lecture is dissolving in front of me. After playing the hero in hundreds of popular Tamil films, he became chief minister of the state in 1977 and retained power until his death in 1987. When he died, MGR's grief-stricken followers rioted in some places and indeed committed suicide in others. And it's estimated that between 2 and 3 million people attended his funeral. His platform, apart from populist championing of the poor and downtrodden, was constructed somewhere along the lines out of the basic assumptions of Dravidian nationalism. Dravidian nationalism itself interprets contemporary South Indian social identities in terms of that great Victorian just-so story in which Indian social differences are the product of the invasion by light-skinned northern Aryans who forced the indigenous dark-skinned Dravidians down to the southern reaches of the subcontinent, a theory popular in Victorian anthropology, long since discredited in European and American anthropology, but taken as a sine qua non in political discourse in large parts of India. Powerful Brahmins are seen as the surviving representatives of this alien northern presence, and the Dravidian movement first took form as an anti-Brahmin cultural and religious force in the 30s. So the people that MGR spoke for and or symbolised were the Dravidian people, the mass of the southern population. And as their representative, MGR seems to have inhabited an extraordinary cultural space midway between the fantasies of the movie industry and the fantasies of the political arena. Both his caste identity and even his linguistic and ethnic origins were surprisingly hazy for a region and a political order in which these things are usually thought to matter a great deal. His successor, Jayalalitha, who is currently just in power, she was, as far as I know, still in power this morning, but it's by no means guaranteed that she's going to be still in power tonight, played his lover in so many films that no one is sure quite where her screen relationship with MGR ended and her political relationship started. Many fans believed MGR could never die. In films, he played the heroic champion of the poor, singing, "If you follow me, the poor will never suffer." His political stature was summed up by the informant who told Sarah Dickey, on whose account I'm relying, "MGR is a god, MGR is a king, MGR is my leader." And Dickey presents a convincing account of the ways in which MGR used both the institutional structure of his movie fan clubs as a political base, as well as the ways in which his political persona grew out of deep Tamil preoccupations with heroes, kings, and the proper relation between leaders and followers. Now, across the sea in the Tamil areas of Sri Lanka, these same preoccupations can be detected in the extraordinary symbolism of the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, or LTTE, the Tigers, the Tamil Separatist Militia, with their stern hero leader Prabhakaran, and their youthful Kada's obsession with the possibility of a heroic martyr's death. The comparison is revealing because it reinforces my point. Elements of a common cultural and historical heritage can be seen to inform Tamil politics in both Sri Lanka and India. And in both cases, politics has been about the solidarity of the Tamil people and their attachment to a superhuman representative. But even as they look so similar, they reveal other differences. This is from a speech by the LTTE leader, Prabhakaran, delivered on Great Heroes Day, November 27th, 1989. And just to explain some of the allusions in the speech, he alludes to a man called Amartalingam, who was the leader of the main constitutional party, the TULF, who had been assassinated by a LTTE hit squad in Colombo a few months earlier. These are Prabhakaran's words translated into English. I have no responsibility for the translation, but they're interesting enough. This is Prabhakaran speaking. "Moreover, where Prabhakaran is concerned, Prabhakaran is not an individual. He is the representative of a nation. Should Prabhakaran become a traitor to Tamil Eelam," this is the putative separate state of Tamil speakers in Sri Lanka, "as did Amartalingam earlier, he too would deserve to be shot. Therefore, as we celebrate Great Heroes Day, traitors should also be extirpated from the midst of the people." This curious passage, with its eerie use of the third person, makes it clear that representation for the LTTE connotes something rather different than representation may do for, say, John Major. The LTTE are close to being a totalitarian organisation, fixated on the prospect of death, and especially unforgiving on enemies and dissenters among what they see as their people. If we turn our attention from the issue of the link between people and representatives and look instead at Burkhardt's analysis of protest in Nepal, we discover further contrasts. What, if anything, constitutes the public sphere in these two cases? Among the poor in Tamil Nadu, according to Dickey, no one pays much attention to newspapers and television news, and the radio is mostly only listened to for movie songs. In her account, and it's the account of one particular part of Tamil Nadu, but in her account, the public sphere appears to be a gendered space occupied by the young men who make up the members of rival fan clubs, while the commonest manifestation of political argument takes the form of attacks on rival stars and their fans. In Sri Lanka, in contrast, in recent years, the Tamil public sphere has not been a space for argument of any sort. This is another quote. "It is a general principle for the LTTE not to engage in ideological discussion with other movements on the same platform," as a recent academic apologist has dryly noted. Imagine yourself listening to a political argument in the poor parts of Madras or Kathmandu, Jaffna or Colombo. Would there be an argument there for you to attend to at all? Or would argument itself be forced into other more oblique forms of expression? If the argument was explicit, you might be reassured or bored to discover that the points of reference of the argument appear familiar. The shortcomings of elected representatives, the changing moods of the people who elected them, the proper actions of government held up against the improper actions of politicians. Yet, as I've tried to show, beneath this surface uniformity, there's a great deal of cultural variation. Variation which inevitably follows from certain features of the common vocabulary of mass politics in the post-colonial world. Within the shared rhetoric of popular sovereignty and political representation,
There is space for new culturally informed imaginings, and thus there is a task for a culturally sensitive anthropology of the politics of the post-colonial world. The task I've suggested is similar to that recently opened up in anthropological studies of the economy. It is to carry the spirit of radical empiricism to the heart of the supposedly neutral categories of late modernity, to find out just what people make of ideas like representation and democracy, and just what they do with the institutional apparatus of the post-colonial state, just as other researchers have been attempting to find out what people elsewhere make of commodities and money. Post-colonialism is a good context in which to explore these themes for three reasons. Because the facts of historical change and rupture are so inescapable in post-colonial contexts. Because the old clichés of tradition versus modernity, exemplified in Malinowski's chalk line on the map, have been so thoroughly exploded by critical historiography. And above all, because the issues themselves are clearly so important to so many post-colonial people. But in the end, as I suggested at the start, the problems of analysing the post-colonial political imagination are not necessarily that different from those faced by our colleagues in Europe, particularly those working in the unstable polities emerging out of the rubble of the old Soviet Empire. Obviously, my themes here have been dictated by my choice of examples. The colonial moment was characterised by what Richard Burckhardt, following Collingwood, called complex agency. And its outcome is also characteristically complex. If I'd chosen other examples, for example, if I'd put together the Buddhist polities of Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma and Cambodia and Laos, we would have found equally striking similarities and equally interesting differences. If I'd chosen examples from West or Central Africa, where the kind of anthropology I'm talking about seems to have become most developed in recent years, I might have been forced to look more closely at the atrophy of the state, at leadership as spectacle and terror, and at the terrible creativity of violence. The settler colonies of Canada, New Zealand and Australia are now post-colonial too, and are much absorbed with the political contradictions of official multiculturalism. Elsewhere in the Pacific, yet other kinds of political imagination are at work, often inflected by local apprehensions of mission teaching and highly self-conscious reflections on local distinctiveness. It follows, then, that there is little to be gained in attempting to talk about the post-colony as a unitary type. And in the diversity of the post-colonial world, we can also see the limits to certain brands of post-colonial theory. My examples, even in this final list, are all evidently post-colonial. These are societies shaped by the recent experience of European domination. To attempt to talk about them without reference to that experience seems to me impossible. And also to talk about them without reflecting on the ways in which that experience also shaped our own understanding of human difference seems to me now, all these years after those first criticisms appeared, quite unforgivable. That much we should surely have learned from the critiques of post-colonial theory. And anthropology is in no position to turn its back on stimulus and criticism from whatever disciplinary source. Nevertheless, I'm just about to do this. Nevertheless, the empirical fact of diversity in politics and in culture suggests that while colonialism deeply changed the societies it touched, it did not change them in predictable unitary directions. Colonialism's effects were diverse because its agents were diverse in their projects and circumstances, and because the societies it touched were also diverse, a point well made recently by Nicholas Thomas. Post-colonial societies are diverse, above all, because colonialism was not always as powerful as we might imagine. Post-colonial theory seems to me sometimes to attribute more cultural power to colonialism than it ever had, ironically denying post-colonial political agents the capacity to intervene in their own inherited circumstances, while ignoring the real diversity of the post-colonial world. The reasons for this are complex, but have much to do with the elective affinity between elite post-colonial intellectuals and the multicultural moment in the American Academy, which of course is where post-colonialism really exists. Some of the effects are dismaying, some are stimulating. Much post-colonial theory seems less concerned with exploring the morally unsettling world of contemporary post-colonial societies than with confronting the moral certainties of white middle-class America. In this peculiarly American argument, colonialism often comes to stand as a means to talk about the searing contemporary experience of race in America. while the political concerns of those who live outside Europe and North America drift out of the analytic frame or are dismissed on loftily theoretical grounds. Moreover, the anti-enlightenment, anti-humanist posture carried over from the gros legume, the big vegetables of French post-structural theory, is hardly the most useful political tool for analysing parts of the world in which grinding poverty, political violence and the denial of human rights remain, quite rightly, major concerns of those intellectuals who have stayed behind. So, while the multiculturalisation of the American Academy seems to me on the whole a highly laudable project, and one we would do well to emulate a lot of the time here, it should not be confused with the need to make sense of the post-colonial world in which we live. Getting American undergraduates to read Frantz Fanon has its political purposes, but these purposes are far removed from the plight of Fanon's old comrades in the leftist intelligentsia, who have been murdered in their thousands in recent years in Algeria, and as far as I can see, whose plight is in no way aided by post-colonial theory. Hindu-Muslim antagonism in India may or may not be best viewed as a colonial construct, but calling it a construct, alas, neither makes it disappear, nor, it would seem, does it lessen its importance to millions of Indians. If it does anything, it widens the gulf between the intellectual and the people on whom he or she is commentating. Of course, some constructs did disappear or decline. Think of the very different fate of Christianity in different post-colonies, while others have taken on a life of their own. In understanding that life, there is a place, I suggest, for an anthropology, I hope a suitably modest and abashed anthropology, not least abashed by its encounter with its own colonial history and the presuppositions it's carried forward from that. The lesson I've tried to extract from that history is an old one, that anthropology needs to approach the post-colonial world with its eyes wide open to all that concerns the people it deals with. Thank you.
It's not been the custom of the ancestors to invite questions after the Malinowski lecture, so it just remains for me to thank Jonathan Spencer very much for an extremely incisive and eloquent lecture. He's provided us with a salutary reminder that the flip side of Malinowski's project of de-exoticizing the apparently exotic is the exoticization of the apparently familiar. And he's provided us also with a very interesting personal manifesto for quickening the dead, that is, for breathing new life into a discipline that he diagnoses as having died of boredom. So I'd like to say that I think, and I'm sure many other people will think, that manifesto is, in many respects, extremely congenial, and to thank him very much for an absolutely splendid lecture, and to hope that our guests will join us on the fifth floor for a drink. Thank you.